In the name of the one holy and ever-living God. Amen. I confess, I had some difficulty with the texts this week. If you are paying attention to the gospel, you'll know what I mean. This passage of the unjust steward or the dishonest manager is, as many commentators will tell you, one of the most difficult to understand in the New Testament. So, fun for me, I guess. I wrestled with this passage, especially in light of the recent and ongoing UAW strike at GM. I don't know if I've told you this or not. I think I have, but I was thinking a lot of my father as I heard the news about the UAW strike. He worked in a Champion spark plug factory most of his life, certainly when I was growing up. And I remember him being on strike a couple of times and trying to wrap my head around it as a child of 6 or 7, what it meant for him to be on strike. It's very hard to understand. I don't remember it especially, but I am told I really liked the government cheese. I believe it because I loved Velveeta, and I've heard they're very similar. But my father was also a man of the church and taught Sunday school. And so for me, these were never in conflict. The welfare of workers and the welfare of the Spirit were deeply connected in the person of my father. And so I've been thinking about a lot of that as I came to the texts today. And I was struck once again, especially by Amos, just how unequivocal the biblical warnings of riches are. I'm occasionally surprised by even my fellow clergy who get into ordained ministry only to find themselves concerned that the salaries are more modest than what they were making in the practice of law or the world of finance. I'm not entirely sure how they missed all the times the Bible has strong words for the rich, because it really is a running theme throughout the scriptures, as we see in most of the readings for today. The poor are, as it were, constantly on God's mind and in God's heart. And those who are ever close to falling into poverty. And the fundamental assumption behind what the Bible tells us is God's concern for the poor, or what can also be called and has been called God's preferential option for the poor. What's behind all of that is the assumption that the poor do not need to be poor. There's nothing especially wrong with them, but they are poor because the rich have made it so. That's what Amos addresses in the name of God in our Old Testament lesson. The rich. He says, "Hear this, you that trample on the needy and bring to ruin the poor of the land." And he adds with a flourish, saying, "When will the new moon be over so that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath so that we may offer wheat for sale?" In other words, when can we stop all this silliness with God, which is just kind of a show, and return to our real God? The God we worship 6 days out of 7, and only stop on the 7th because everyone tells us we should. These rich, Amos says, buy the poor for silver and the needy for the cost of a pair of sandals. They exploit in order to gain. Now, some might say that's just the free market at work. That's just the cost of doing business. But not in God's kingdom. Another prophetic voice from the century just past, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, is well known for his work in racial civil rights and the work of breaking down racial disparity and and white supremacy. But he was also mindful of the economic challenges, the challenges of workers and of the poor. If you've never had the opportunity to read his imaginative little piece, Paul's Letter to American Christians, I encourage you to look it up when you get home. You can find it online pretty easily. Under the pretense of having found a lost letter of Paul's and having translated from the Greek to the best of his abilities, it really is a cute little tongue-in-cheek thing he does at the beginning, Dr. King writes a letter in Pauline style to American Christians. And in the letter, he has Paul say that he needs to write about the responsibilities of living a Christian life in an unchristian world. As Romans says, not being conformed to the world, but being transformed by the renewing of our minds. Or as Philippians says, being citizens of heaven, holding that dual citizenship in time and eternity. And like Paul, he praises many things about America in the late 60s. He also offers warnings. Dr. King's Paul talks about the dangers of nuclear war and war in general, and of course about racism and white supremacy. He also talks about our economic structures. I'm going to quote a little bit at length here, but trust me, it's good. I understand, he says, that you have an economic system in America known as capitalism. Through this economic system, you have been able to do wonders. You have become the richest nation in the world, and you have built up the greatest system of production that history has ever known. All of this is marvelous. But Americans, there is a danger that you will misuse your capitalism. I still contend that money can be the root of all evil. It can cause one to live a life of gross materialism. And I am afraid that many among you are more concerned about making a living than making a life. The misuse of capitalism can also lead to tragic exploitation. This has so often happened in your nation. They tell me that 0.1% of the population controls more than 40% of the wealth. And I wish I could tell you it's gotten better since the 60s, but alas, no. Oh, America, he continues, how often have you taken necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes? If you are to be a truly Christian nation, you must solve this problem. God never intended for one group of people to live in superfluous, inordinate wealth, while others live in abject, deadening poverty. God intends for all of his children to have the basic necessities of life, and he has left in this universe enough and to spare for that purpose. Now, in case any of you are beginning to wonder, no, the good Dr. King was not a communist. In fact, I left out the bit where he says, we do not need to turn to communism to solve this problem, but we can rely on the structures of democracy to more justly distribute the wealth of the nation. Those are his words, distribute the wealth. Now, I know some of us have an allergic reaction to that, to those words, redistributing wealth. Some voices in this nation have perhaps convinced us that it is a bad word, an un-American turn of phrase. Whether or not it is un-American, I think, remains to be seen. It is not, however, unbiblical. I know there are those who think redistribution of wealth is an unjust idea, an immoral one, and that's a shame. Because had they read their scriptures, they would realize it's a very biblical idea. Across the Bible, from the law of Moses to the great prophets, to the Psalms, to Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, and let us not forget, even in the Magnificat of Mother Mary, God hears the cry of the poor and takes up their cause, casting down the mighty from their thrones and lifting up the lowly, filling the hungry with good things and sending the rich away empty. And that's not even the most startling language a Christian could find. John Ruskin, writing in the 19th century, witnessing the excesses of capitalism in England, put it in much starker terms. When I read this some years ago, I had to catch my breath. The definite result, he says, of all our modern haste to be rich is assuredly and constantly the murder of a certain number of persons by our hands every year. The choice given to every man born into this world is simply whether he will be a laborer or an assassin, and that whosoever has not his hand on the stilt of the plow has it on the hilt of the dagger. Arresting language, indeed. Well worth pondering. Go home on a cheerful Sunday afternoon and ponder that. Well, where does the unjust steward, the dishonest manager, fit in all of this? I want to begin by saying this is not the only way to read this passage, because if you find the best way to read this passage, come and talk to me. I'd like to hear it. It's a tricky text, to be sure, and there are many avenues toward which it might point us. In fact, I think the parables are largely there to point us toward our own hearts and what God is saying to them, and not necessarily to find the one point in them. So I'm going to try to wrestle with that just a little bit here to conclude. First of all, the master in the story is a rich man. And by now, I think we're prepared to understand by that, in the biblical narrative, a rich man is usually an exploitative man. Someone who has gotten their wealth by making sure that others stay unwealthy. A man who has built his life on the backs of the lives of others without taking proper account of them. His accounting books are olive oil. His accounting books are goods and commodities, not human beings. And the unjust manager, or the dishonest manager, happens to be dishonest about an unjust practice. So, in some senses, one thinks, well, maybe that's for the good. But I think the part of the story that gives me hope, in which I hear good news, is when the manager says, well, what will I do now? He's about to be broken on the wheel of this exploitative system, and he comes to a decision point. What will I do now? And perhaps it's a bit optimistic of an interpretation, but I think what he decides is to live his life a little bit more in solidarity, to use his power to benefit those who are under the thumb of the system. How much do you owe my master? 100 jugs of olive oil. Let's make that 50, shall we? And it's self-serving, sure, because we all rise together, or not at all. But it seems to me that he has decided to put solidarity with the people first. Even if it's out of selfish motives, he ends up doing the right thing. And that leads me to wonder what we will do. Systems are good. Institutions are good as instruments. But this story and the biblical narrative in general tells us that these instruments must be for the bettering of human lives. All human lives, and not just ours. With a preference especially for the poor and those in need, a class of Americans that continues to grow. It might tell us that sometimes to be a good steward, we must be unjust or dishonest in the eyes of society as we press for at least a conversation about reparations and for the realignment of wealth. I read a story this week about the UVA basketball coach who has signed up for another 7 years but declined a bump in salary and instead redirected some of those funds to helping his players. That's the sort of working with the system that brings us all together. That sort of work on behalf of those who need it, of those who need health care, of those who need better wages, is not a political party's province alone, but is the responsibility of all of us, yes, as Christians. So how might we hear this story and realign ourselves in solidarity with the poor and the needy? How might we learn to see the poor not as a problem, but as our brothers and sisters? How might we find ourselves wrapped up in God's love and grace so much that we find ourselves working to make everyone's lives better? Amen.